Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present retired CAA analyst Ray McGovern, who assesses the unfolding scandal surrounding the White House in which Bush administration officials are accused of leaking the identity of a CIA covert operative. Cuba's Foreign Minister Felipe Perez Roque, who spoke in Harlem about the latest developments in U.S.-Cuba relations, a global system of sustainable development, and the U.S. war in Iraq. And Bev Harris, author of the book Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century, who examines the serious flaws found in electronic voting systems now being used across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The town of Altar, Mexico, is the staging area for thousands of Latino immigrants seeking to enter the United States. That is the place to find a smuggler and rent a bed to rest before the long, hot journey ahead. Some, like Maria Morales, are trying to get back into the U.S. She had left her husband and children in Denver so she could care for her dying mother in Mexico. Now the undocumented immigrant has to pay a smuggler, or pollero, to get her to Phoenix. Since May, when 19 Latino immigrants died in an airless tractor trailer in South Texas, the government of Mexican President Vicente Fox has tried to clamp down on the smuggling rings. Yet officials on both sides of the border say the crackdown has had little impact. Much of the increased migrant flow over the last decade, critics say, is caused by the dire impact of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which has helped exacerbate poverty across Mexico. Latino migrants quickly move through the U.S. in search of job prospects. They are headed for Midwest meatpacking plants, chicken processors in Alabama, or service jobs in big cities. In the face of post-September 11th government deportations of undocumented workers, immigrants, their advocates, and unions have recently initiated campaigns for amnesty and legalization. Over the summer, Vicky Nafo, an Israeli divorced mother of three, launched her own social justice protest movement. Outraged by Israel's finance minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plans to slash her supplemental income by 50%, Nafo, a part-time cook at a daycare center, decided to walk 200 kilometers and demand a meeting with Netanyahu, a free market conservative. While the combative Netanyahu refused to meet with the single mother and other activists, the walk sparked media attention and a powerful movement among poor single mothers. By late July, 600 single women had set up a tent city near the Knesset, Israel's parliament. The intense criticism of cuts in benefits to poor women took the Likud government by surprise and led to a great deal of soul-searching among Israeli opinion makers. Some attacked the women for not looking harder for employment, while others blasted Netanyahu for his heavy-handed tactics towards the poor. By the end of July, Israeli President Moshe Katsav, who had little formal power, met with the protesting mothers and heard their stories about the difficulty in finding work. Overall, the protests have sparked debate in Israel, a nation founded by European socialists, about current government policies which are undermining the social safety net for the poor, the sick, and the elderly. In early August, John Sweeney's AFL-CIO had a moment of truth. For months, Sweeney had been upset over the participation of the Carpenters Union in the important Building and Construction Trades Council, despite the Carpenters' decision to leave the Labor Federation in 2001. According to the American Prospect magazine, the Carpenters' dual role was a clear violation of the AFL-CIO Constitution, which bans unions that do not pay Federation dues from belonging to AFL-CIO committees. Sweeney wanted the Executive Council to break all links with the Carpenters. But the Executive Council balked, delaying any action until 2005. What's surprising to many observers is that Carpenters Union President Doug McCarron, who has celebrated Labor Day with President George W. Bush, got support from Labor's progressive wing. John Wilhelm of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees International Union, Andy Stern, president of the Service Employees International Union, and Bruce Rayner of the Union of Needle Trade, Industrial, and Textile Workers Union. Wilhelm, Stern, and Rayner all came out of the 60s protest movement and went to Ivy League colleges. For the past 20 years, they moved up labor's ranks by organizing thousands of new workers. In recent years, they have met resistance by many AFL-CIO unions to their proposals for spending more money on recruitment and organizing. But the more conservative Carpenters Union has endorsed organizing as the key to labor's survival. These unions have cooperated together in efforts to invest strategically to strengthen new organizing efforts in hotels, construction sites, and among janitors. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
As attacks on American troops continue in U.S.-occupied Iraq and the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians spills over into neighboring Syria, the White House is also being forced to deal with growing scandals at home. The Justice Department and FBI have begun an investigation into allegations that Bush administration officials leaked the identity of a covert CIA operative to a conservative columnist. Valerie Plame, the CIA agent whose identity was revealed, is the wife of former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who had publicly refuted President Bush's claim that Iraq was seeking uranium in the African nation of Niger for a nuclear weapons program. The White House had sent Wilson to Africa in 2002 to investigate the matter but ignored his findings. President Bush repeated the charge in his January State of the Union speech, using it as a key justification for war. Ambassador Wilson has accused White House officials, including the president's chief political adviser, Karl Rove, of engineering or condoning the leak to punish him and to intimidate other government officials from going public with criticism of President Bush's manipulation of intelligence to justify his war on Iraq. The Justice Department FBI investigation of the matter has come under attack from Democrats who point out the obvious conflict of interest Attorney General John Ashcroft has in leading an inquiry against his boss, President Bush. But thus far, the White House has resisted demands from congressional Democrats to appoint a special counsel to conduct the probe. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with retired 27-year veteran CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who assesses the unfolding scandal surrounding the White House, which he says presents the nation with a serious constitutional crisis.
I think it's probably worth reminding ourselves who Ambassador Joseph Wilson is. He was our acting ambassador in Baghdad during the first Gulf War. There were hundreds of American refugees in the embassy compound in Baghdad. Joe Wilson faced down Saddam Hussein and secured the release, the free release, almost immediate release, of all those Westerners, primarily Americans. He just showed incredible courage and received all kinds of commendations from George Herbert Walker Bush, who was the president at the time. So he knows Iraq. Now, he also has a special place in his heart for Africa, where he served in several countries, and he served in Niger. So he was the quintessential person qualified to go down there and look into these reports that Iraq was seeking uranium in Niger. He went down there and discovered that it was impossible, that they couldn't have been because the government of Niger couldn't have given it to them anyway. Well, when Joe came back, he reported that duly to mostly to Vice President Cheney's office, because it was Cheney's office who was most interested in this report. Then imagine Joe Wilson's surprise when the President of the United States, 11 months later, namely on January 28th of this year, included in the State of the Union address that same report, saying that, well, the way he put it was, the British have learned that Iraq was seeking uranium in an African country. Well, Joe was horrified, as were all the other people who knew what the real story was. But Joe, you know, he took the initiative and he checked around with his State Department colleagues and found out, he said, you know, is there some other African country that, no, it was all based on that same one. Well, now Joe has a choice, okay? Joe said, hey, this is an important matter. We're talking about war and peace here. This is what the president used to justify this war. I need to make public the fact that this was not right. And so he did this article. Not only that, but in an interview coincident with the article, he told Washington Post reporters this. He said, this whole escapade begs the question with respect to what else they're lying about. But in doing that, saying what he did, he threw down the gauntlet. And the White House, looking at this, said, my God, you know, can we let Wilson get away with this? What are the risks? Well, the risks are great, because there are hundreds of people who know what Joe Wilson is referring to when he says what else they're lying about. They know about all the lies. Now, if we let Wilson say this kind of thing and do not retaliate against him, let him do this with impunity, that's going to send the wrong message. So how do we get at him? Well, one of the reporters was told by the White House official that wives are fair game. Well, that's what turned out to be the case. They found out that Joe Wilson's wife, she was a deep cover official. She was working on weapons of mass destruction, the precise priority one issue facing the United States government. Well, they decided to retaliate for what Ambassador Wilson had said and make this an object lesson to all others who might be tempted to speak out about the lies.
Ray McGovern, CIA Director George Tenet has asked for an investigation, and the Justice Department is now working with the FBI to conduct an investigation into who revealed Ambassador Joseph Wilson's wife's name to the press as a CIA operative. How credible and aggressive will this investigation be, in your opinion?
I think it will be just as credible and just as intense as the one that President Richard Nixon ordered Attorney General John Mitchell to undertake. I think he called it a full and thorough investigation of Watergate. Let's not deceive ourselves. The FBI answers to the Justice Department. Indeed, the fellow who's been named to head up this investigation is well known in intelligence circles as he would hardly go to the bathroom without checking with his superiors in the Justice Department.
Who is that?
That's John Dionne. What you've got here is a situation where John Ashcroft will be calling all the shots. I leave the rest to your imagination. It doesn't take a lot of imagination.
Given that you feel we are in the midst of a constitutional crisis, what should Congress be doing, and what should the public be demanding they do?
Well, there's the ideal, and there's the practical. The ideal is that there are ample grounds for impeachment. This is clearly an impeachable offense, lying to the Congress and to the American people on a matter of war and peace, starting an unprovoked war. America has never done that before, not on the scale. This orchestrating a plan of deceit over a period of several months. So, an impeachable offense, of course it is. Number two, the practical. The president's party controls both houses of the Senate. There's no way that any of his colleagues are going to rise above their partisan affiliation and demand his impeachment. So it's a practical call. Do you waste a lot of energy trying to raise articles of impeachment, or do you turn your attention to the other part of the Constitution, which says the president has to be elected every 4 years? And I think that for practical reasons, and since the president is so vulnerable now, that we'll see this played out in the political arena as the Democrats get their act together, perhaps, if they ever can, and field a candidate who can sharpen these issues and make them abundantly clear to the American people.
That was veteran CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who until his retirement in 1990 led one of two CIA teams conducting the most secret daily intelligence briefings at the White House. His recent article, Conscience Before Career, can be read online at www.tompaine.com. Cuba's foreign minister, Felipe Perez Roque, was recently in New York for the opening of the United Nations General Assembly. On Saturday, September 27th, Perez Roque was the keynote speaker at the Church of the Intercession in Harlem, where he addressed a standing-room-only crowd of about 700. Earlier, speaking before the UN General Assembly, Perez Roque denounced Washington's occupation of Iraq and later met with 265 Cuban Americans from across the U.S. at Local 1199 in Manhattan. Actor Harry Belafonte introduced Cuba's Minister of Foreign Affairs, and a brief history of U.S.-Cuba relations was delivered by co-chair of the event and historian Jane Franklin. In his speech at the Church of the Intercession, he spoke about the internationalist approach Cuba has of exporting the benefits of the revolution by sending doctors, other professionals, and medicines to countries in times of crisis. Roque also talked about the latest developments in U.S.-Cuba relations, a global system of sustainable development, and the U.S. war in Iraq.
Almost 900 million people
en el mundo
around the world
son adultos analfabetos.
Are illiterate adults.
Más de 800 millones
More
de personas
than 800 million people
pasan hambre.
Starve.
11 millones de niños,
11 million children,
menores de 5 años,
under the age of 5,
morirán este año,
will die this year,
de enfermedades prevenibles,
of preventable diseases,
enfermedades que se pueden prevenir con vacunas,
diseases which can be prevented through vaccines,
morirán de diarreas,
and they will die of diarrhea,
y otros 6 millones de niños,
and another 6 million children,
morirán de desnutrición,
will die of undernourishment.
Eso en un mundo que produce los alimentos suficientes.
In a world which is producing enough foodstuffs,
nosotros creemos que un mundo mejor es posible.
We believe that a better world is possible.
Que hay manera. Y ser un fracaso la conferencia de Cancún de la Organización Mundial del Comercio.
The Cancun conference hosted by the World Trade Organization has just been a failure.
Porque los países desarrollados,
because developed countries,
no quieren ceder sus privilegios.
Do not want to give up their privileges.
Nuestros países no tienen acceso a las nuevas tecnologías.
To the new technologies.
No pueden educar a su población.
They cannot educate their population.
No pueden desarrollarse.
They cannot achieve their development.
Hay que transformar el actual sistema económico internacional.
So the current international economic system has to be transformed.
El Fondo Monetario Internacional,
the International Monetary Fund,
impone a los países pobres,
imposes upon poor people,
programas de ajuste,
some adjustment programs,
que desestabilizan a los países,
which destabilize these countries,
que hacen a los pobres más pobres,
and which make the poor be poorer,
que destruyen la riqueza nacional,
and which destroy the natural resources and wealth.
Es necesario,
it is necessary then,
un nuevo sistema económico internacional,
to have an international, a new international economic system,
basado en la solidaridad,
based on solidarity,
en el sentido común,
based on common sense,
en el desarrollo sostenible,
based on sustainable development,
y no en el derroche de unos
and
pocos,
not based on the squandering by just a few,
a costa del hambre y la miseria para la mayoría,
at the expense of the hardships and the famine of the majority.
Disminuirían los gastos militares.
There would be a decrease in military expenditure.
Y resulta que este año,
and it turns out that this year,
se gastarán en armas.
There will be expenses on arms
más
amounting to
de 900 mil millones de dólares.
Over 900 billion US dollars.
La mitad de ello en Estados Unidos.
Half of those expenses in the United States.
¿Por qué no se dedica el dinero de las armas?
Why isn't that money for arms set aside?
Para combatir las enfermedades.
To fight diseases.
Para combatir el analfabetismo.
And to fight illiteracy.
Para combatir el hambre,
fight hunger,
se requiere democratizar las relaciones internacionales.
Also required is the democratization of international relations.
La paz internacional,
international peace,
no puede fundarse,
cannot be founded,
en el uso de la fuerza,
on the use of force.
La verdad debe ser dicha con respeto.
The truth must be told with all due respect.
Pero debe ser dicho.
But it must be told, in fact,
la guerra en Irak,
the war in Iraq,
no ayuda a la paz internacional.
It's not instrumental in bringing about international peace.
Vemos con dolor,
we see with pain,
como mueren jóvenes norteamericanos,
how American youths are dying,
en una guerra injusta,
in an unjust war,
una guerra que el mundo no apoya,
a war that was not supported by the world.
Un día,
one day,
se probará,
it will prove,
que nuestros sueños de hoy,
it will be proven that the dreams that we have today,
serán las realidades de mañana,
will become the realities of tomorrow.
Un día el bloqueo será levantado.
One day the blockade will have to be lifted.
Un día habrá relaciones,
one day there will be
normales entre nuestros
normal
pueblos,
relations between our people.
Y un día,
and one day,
un mundo mejor,
a better world,
será posible,
will be possible.
Les damos las gracias.
We would like to thank you.
Gracias.
Thank you.
That was Cuba's Foreign Minister, Felipe Perez Roque, speaking in Harlem at the Church of the Intercession on Saturday, September 27th. This segment was recorded and produced by your reporter, Denise Manzari. In response to the controversial outcome of the 2000 presidential election and the flawed paper ballots and hanging chads that disenfranchised tens of thousands of voters in Florida, Congress allocated billions of dollars to modernize the nation's voting machinery. But as new electronic voting machine systems are being purchased and put to use, they have come under greater scrutiny. Computer specialists analyzing equipment being purchased by the state of Maryland from the Diebold Election Systems Company issued a report which found this technology is at high risk of compromise and vulnerable to computer hackers and voting fraud. The report prepared for Maryland by the Science Applications International Corporation confirmed an earlier examination of Diebold equipment that concluded security gaps in the equipment could be exploited to let people vote many times or change their votes after they were cast. But despite these warnings of security flaws, Maryland officials are proceeding with the purchase of Diebold machines. Currently, more than 30,000 electronic voting machines built by various companies are being used in 38 states, a fact that has critics concerned about the security and accuracy of future election results. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bev Harris, author of the book Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century, who examines the serious flaws found in electronic voting systems and how this could profoundly affect the public's trust in the machinery of democracy.
I'm not actually opposed to electronic voting. I think it could be a very good thing. The problem is they took away the audit trail, which virtually guarantees that there will be fraud at some point. And by the audit trail, what I simply mean is that we have to retain evidence of what the vote is, and that we need to do in the form of a voter-verified ballot, in other words, a ballot on paper that we can look at as a voter and verify that, yes, that's how we voted, and it needs to be retained in evidence. What really happened that caused us to make this big rush toward these electronic machines was a bunch of defense contractors and some procurement agents decided that it would make a whole lot of profit for certain people if we could get this bill passed through Congress, which would allocate $3.8 billion toward the purchase of these new machines. This is information, by the way, that just came out August 22nd in a meeting that my publisher attended with a bunch of the voting machine vendors. It was a teleconference, and they never asked him who he was. He said his name, and they didn't ask who he was, and he sat in on the whole meeting, and they discussed the whole evolution of the HAVA bill, the Help America Vote Act. And, in fact, it really was pushed through by the likes of Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and Accenture and so forth. And they, in fact, they were quite explicit in this meeting. It was pushed through for the purpose of setting up profit centers for them. And so what we really need to do is kind of get everybody out of the pool and start over again and do it right.
Bev Harris, tell us where these electronic voting machines are now in use in the states across the country. And maybe you could describe for us a recent report that was sought and delivered to the state of Maryland on the eve of their purchasing a lot of these machines for use in their next election.
The electronic voting machines are basically, there's two kinds. One is an optical scan machine where you can either fill in a bubble or you draw a line between two candidates, and then you run the vote through a machine and it counts it. That does have a paper trail, but the problem is they're not using that, and they're not allowed by law in many states to ever look at the actual ballots. So it's the same thing as doing kind of blind electronic voting. The other ones are the touch screens, and between those two, all states have them now, and a huge percentage of America is voting on them.
The state of Maryland is on the verge of buying
right.
a lot of these electronic machines.
Right.
Describe what was reported to the state of Maryland.
It's the SAIC report. They solicited the report because some scientists from Johns Hopkins and Rice University uncovered really stunning security flaws. The SAIC then did a supposedly independent analysis. Now, the SAIC is not really independent. It is involved in the voting machine industry, so there's a little concern there. And they could have done a much better job, and they redacted out more than two-thirds of the report. But based on what we even saw, they uncovered 328 security flaws, of which they deemed 26 critical. And for some bizarre reason, the state of Maryland decided to go ahead with the machines anyway.
Summarize for us the most serious and concerning flaws that have been found in these machines.
Well, one of the flaws that I found, which I was really disturbed by, is that they have a back door that's quite accessible to anyone who can get at the machine, basically, or anybody who can get at it through remote means by hacking in a telephone line or whatever. And the county machine that does the central tabulation, actually anybody who wants to can get at it can change anything they want on it. If you go in the regular way, which we'd call the front door, it seems very secure, and you can do just the right things and, you know, run reports and so forth. However, it produces a little file which installs itself in another little folder and on your Windows desktop, and all it takes is double-clicking that file, and you're in the back door, and you can change anything you want, including passwords, the audit trail, and the votes themselves.
Tell us a little bit about your investigations into concerns that companies like Diebold are not politically neutral, that in fact Diebold and some of these other companies are large contributors to one or another political parties. I believe in Diebold's case, they are strong and generous supporters of the Republican Party.
Right. Well, it's beyond being just a generous supporter. The CEO of Diebold is what's called a Bush pioneer. Bush has a group of pioneers and rangers, which are the top 100 fundraisers and strategists in the country for his campaign and so forth. Well, one of these people, one of these 100, is the CEO of Diebold, who recently hosted a fundraiser for Dick Cheney, raised $600,000, and then penned a letter to the Republicans in the state of Ohio promising, and I quote, to deliver the votes for Bush in the 2004 election, which is a very inappropriate statement for somebody who runs a voting machine company. Diebold has also got another director who is a Bush pioneer, a fellow named, by the name of W.H. Timkinen. So they've got two of the 100 top people raising money for the campaign of President Bush. And then ESNS, which is actually the largest company counting votes in the United States, is directly tied to a Republican senator.
That was Bev Harris, author of the book Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century, published by Plan 9. Visit the publisher's website to access a free download of the book at www.blackboxvoting.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Sasha Summer Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.